It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back next week. Well, rock and roll legend Greg Allman recently released a memoir that chronicles his life and career and also tells the story of arguably one of the best rock and roll bands of that day and perhaps even of any day, the Allman Brothers. And this hour we're going to talk about Greg Allman and the Allman Brothers. We'll hear some clips of an interview I did earlier this week with Greg. But joining me is Alan Light, former editor-in-chief of Spin Magazine and frequent contributor to Rolling Stone and the New York Times. He was the co-writer with Greg Allman of the book My Cross to Bear, which has been getting some pretty good reviews. The New York Times review was very complimentary of this book. Alan Light, good morning. Thanks for being with me today.
Yes, hi, good morning. Happy to be here.
How did you get involved in this project?
Well, I did a story actually for the New York Times, trying to remember exactly how long ago, but beginning maybe of last year, end of the previous, and when Greg put out his last solo record, Low Country Blues, which was a fantastic record that ended up nominated for a Grammy. And so I did a story for the Sunday New York Times with him at that time. And then a couple months after that, he signed to deliver the book, and we kind of each approached each other. You know, I guess he was happy with the piece I'd done and with working with me, and I thought it would be an amazing story to get involved with, and we met a couple times and took it from there.
How did the book writing process work?
Well, this was interesting and atypical in some ways, in that, as he says in the book, he had tried starting towards a book project a couple of times over the years, that even as far back as the 80s, he had started taking notes. And then about 10 years ago, put some more time to it, maybe toward an Allman Brothers book or something. It wasn't clear. And so when they decided, you know, to sign and actually do the full project, the first thing was I was given all of this stuff that had been done previously, you know, hundreds of pages of transcripts and things to go through, see what was there, see, you know, which things worked and didn't, which things needed to be fleshed out, what needed to be updated. And so started to build a skeleton out of that, and then started to spend time with him going through all the rest of it and really trying to make it complete. We mostly were at his house in Savannah, Georgia. That was where the bulk of our time was, and then, you know, some other meetings along the way.
I mean, the book is reads as a remarkable first person account. I mean, he's giving us the eyewitness account of his life, and it's I think I could use the word unfiltered.
I think it's a very honest, sometimes very very raw kind of honest perspective on really one of the amazing stories in American music. This filled with sort of gothic tragedy and twists within both family life and band life that it's hard to think of anybody else who's gone through this kind of saga.
Well, let's talk about that. And I don't want to go through the entire book because we don't have that much time. So we'll probably kind of skip along to some of the highlights. But certainly we have to mention the fact that both Greg and his older brother, Dwayne, basically grew up without a father because their father was murdered when Greg was 2 years old. That they had a pretty rough start at first.
Well, certainly. Greg has, you know, has no memories of his father. His father was a military officer who was home on leave and was picked up, was in a bar with a friend of his, and they picked up basically a guy who was asking for a ride somewhere, who ended up trying to rob them and then shooting Greg's dad. Greg was 2 and Dwayne was 3 years old at the time. And, you know, from there on in, he says his mother, you know, he remembers her going on one date. She really, you know, was not interested in replacing his dad, She served as both parents, and it also really solidified a relationship with Dwayne, where even though he's only a year older, he was really the grown-up, the closest to a father figure, the closest to a role model that Greg had through all his life. And this is really, the book is really the first time that he's talked in any kind of detail about what happened to his dad, about that story and the impact that it had on him.
Yeah, he starts right out. I mean, I guess the thing, you used the term raw earlier. I mean, he doesn't pull any punches here. He's basically saying what he thinks about pretty much everything in his life. He doesn't paint himself in an overly complimentary way for some of the book, but it's sort of like he says, "This is my life. It is what it is. Here I am."
Yeah, and certainly for me is working with him on this and trying to help shape that into a story. There's not much more that you could ask from a subject or for a writer than to approach his own experiences with that kind of openness. And that was really the thing that I needed to be convinced of before getting involved in a project like this. I've seen too many other people. I've seen too many friends of mine get involved with, these kinds of memoirs, and the subject really doesn't, they don't really understand what it's going to take, what kind of commitment and what kind of openness to deliver the story that people really want to hear. I've seen plenty of these books just kind of flame out or happen in a not satisfying way, and I needed to be convinced that this was something Greg really wanted to do, that he was ready to put the time into it, and more than that, he was ready to put his own thoughts and feelings into it and give the full story. Allman Brothers fans are, as with many bands, especially of that era, there are fans who are rabid in their intensity. They've been following this band for decades. They know a lot of the story, but they don't know all of the story. And, you're aware of a responsibility to try to deliver something that's going to be complete and going to be insightful and going to be real. And he stayed true to that through the whole process.
I'm going to put a call out here to our listeners who I would encourage to join the discussion. And I'll just say this, for those of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s and for whom the Allman Brothers was a big deal, I can still remember when the Fillmore East Live album came out, that was about the time I discovered the Allman Brothers. I was a freshman in college and my roommate turned me on to it. And wow, it was like, holy cow, who does this? And I want to hear from people who are maybe fans of the Allman Brothers. When did you first discover them, and what did their music mean to you? 800-486-8655 is the phone number. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org, or find us on Facebook. There's a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can leave a comment or question there. 800-486-8655. We're talking about the book My Cross to Bear, Greg Allman's autobiography, and we have his co-author with us, Alan Light. Where did the title My Cross to Bear come from?
Well, one of the one of the classic Allman Brothers songs, a song called Not My Cross to Bear, which was one of the first songs that Greg wrote, and one of the first that he, in the very first session, the first time he was brought together with the rest of the Allman Brothers band, Not My Cross to Bear was one of the songs that they played. And, so it's been a staple of the band and a real landmark song for them for many, many decades now. But I think when we were, looking at ideas, looking at titles, I think there is this sense with Greg that he's been so surrounded by tragedy. As we mentioned, his father's murder, obviously, his brother's death, and then the death of Barry Oakley, their bass player, the following year, that there's been a lot of burden, a lot of pain and a lot of burden in his life, and a lot that he's had to carry with him as he's really turned into such a survivor, and not a particularly likely one as you read about, how he lived for many of these years and in and out of rehab, 12 or 14 times. He has persevered against the odds, and that kind of, that title seemed to get that mood and that idea across.
I want to skip ahead to when Greg and Dwayne first picked up the guitar, and Greg told me this story the other day when we were talking, and I want to let's go to that cut right now, how he first got a guitar.
It was a little painful, but he told me they make guitars that he says they make them that you can't even feel them. He was a Mr. Exaggeration. He said, you know, you just barely touch right there and there. So that saved me there, because I was thinking, man, if it hurts this bad to play a guitar, then pass, you know.
You paid $22 for your first guitar. How did you learn how to play it?
I kind of figured it out on my own. I was shown the basic map. And there are basically three chords to country music, blues, and rock and roll. It's called a three-chord turnaround. Instead of calling them out by their names, we just, they've left it like wide open. I mean, like, no matter what key you're in, you play the one. The one's the tonic. That's the key that you're in. The one, four, and five.
He, at the beginning of that clip, he referenced someone who showed him the guitar first. It was actually a neighbor across the street, I believe, who first showed him the guitar, and then he got his own. $22. Boy, those old Silvertones, they were really beaters.
But, you know, it made it possible to get him into the hands of not just him, but, you know, but all those kids who went on to start rock and roll bands in the 60s and go change the world.
I once owned a Silvertone amp, so.
There you go. You can identify. Well, my 9-year-old is, you know, is learning his own. We've stepped him up to something fancier than that, but it's all still the same process.
I really wanted a Fender. it was amazing to me, and as I read the book and as I heard Greg describe it there, you know, here was somebody who didn't have any formal music training, but he figured it out. I mean, he worked with people, and how in the world did he manage this self-education, and Dwayne as well? I mean, neither one of them had any formal music training, and yet here they are. You know, they produced so much really great music together, almost seemingly self-taught.
Well, I don't know if there's ever an answer to you know, how is it or what is it that enables people to do that. I mean, it's fascinating hearing Greg talk about, you know, what kind of natural Dwayne was, because, you know, as I think you said, you know, Greg got a guitar first. He started playing it first. And then Dwayne kind of took an interest in it, and they started fighting over it. But Greg says that, you know, from day one, Dwayne could pick it up, and once he learned a couple of things, could do things that, you know, that he just wasn't capable of. He tells a story later on in the book about, you know, essentially Dwayne figuring out how to play slide guitar in one day. That short version is Dwayne was injured and sick, and it was his birthday, and Greg bought him a Taj Mahal record and a bottle of cold medicine and left it on his doorstep and ran. And a couple hours later, Dwayne called him and was like, you got to come over here. And Dwayne had dumped all the pills out of the cold bottle and figured out, playing along with the Taj Mahal record, how to play slide guitar, you know, and quickly went on to become, you know, essentially the preeminent slide player in rock and roll. These things seem to just happen naturally and instantly. You know, by contrast, Greg, who, you know, is really not a natural front man and is kind of shy and quiet, was put into this position of being a singer, which he really didn't want to do, basically as a way to keep his spot in their first band, because Dwayne was sort of like, well, we know I'm a better guitar player and we've got these other friends who can play, so, you know, we need somebody to sing. Maybe you better figure that out and we'll keep you around. And that it took him a long time studying, learning, watching people, and talking to other musicians just to figure out physically how to make the right sound with his voice and become one of the, you know, certainly one of the most distinctive singers in the rock and roll era.
Well, and one of the things that he talks about in the book is how he learned proper vocal technique from other singers. And it's actually, if anybody wants to do some singing, it's really great advice, and that is you have to support the sound from the diaphragm and not just make it from the throat. Otherwise, you won't last very long. And he was very specific about, you know, making sure he took care of the instrument, so to speak, and didn't overtax it by not singing with correct vocal technique. Any voice teacher would tell you the same thing.
Right. And again, it's something that somebody else had to show him, and that he said he, you know, didn't get at first and had to practice and eventually figured out, oh, this is what they're talking about. This is how you have to hold your gut, and this is what you do with your throat, and here's how you make the right sound. But, you know, as you said, there's no formal training on this stuff. This is just picked up on the road and working with friends and working with other people and watching and listening very closely. And, you know, that's what you hear from, I think, from a lot of the musicians of that generation, when music was, you know, when things were transforming so much, when the style was transforming so much, when there were new opportunities to play and more places to play and an openness to people starting to write their own songs. But all of that was very uncharted territory, and everybody was kind of figuring out as they went along.
We talked about the way that Duane picked up the guitar. One of the things that Greg commented on, and we're going to play this clip here in just a moment, one of the things that that Greg commented on was Duane's fingers and how long they were. Let's listen to that.
He was quite the natural. I was looking at some pictures the other day, old pictures of us, and there's one of me and him out in front of my grandmother's house. And we're like teenagers. But, like, his hands, I guess he'd had a growth spurt or something, but his hands, his fingers almost looked too long for his body, you know what I mean? And it's, I mean, really, he had some claws on him.
Long fingers would be a big help in playing the guitar.
Well, for sure, and you know, and these things, as with natural athletes, sometimes there are physical, you know, there are just explanations for the ways that people can do things. I was just reading a story about Regina Spektor, a singer-songwriter, young singer-songwriter that I like very much, and she was talking about her classical training, and at a certain point, she, you know, her fingers, her hands just weren't big enough to be able to play the chords and the leaps that were demanded to continue in her classical training, and that was really when she started shifting to working more with pop music. Sometimes there's just... you know, there's more simple and pedestrian explanations, but the things that determine the path that your music will take.
Well, it's, yeah, your physical characteristics determine in large measure what you're capable of doing. We're going to take a break. We have some callers. We have some emails to read. We have a lot more music to play this hour. We're talking about Greg Allman's new book, My Cross to Bear, co-written with Alan Light. Alan is with us. We still have some more Greg Allman audio to play for you this hour as well. But we're going to take a quick break now and come back. We'll have phone calls and so forth. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Allman Brothers. Everybody who's an Allman Brothers fan recognizes One Way Out. And we heard that slide guitar that Duane played. That was one of their big songs. It's always been one of my favorites. Thanks, Brett. We're talking about Greg Allman's book, Mike Cross to Bear, with Alan Light, the co-writer of the book, with Greg Allman. And we're talking about about Greg's life, but you can't talk about Greg's life without talking about the Allman Brothers. We had an email from Tom in Brookfield who says, I've been a huge fan for many years and have played in several bands that covered the Allman Brothers songs. They have set the standard in many ways, double drummers, sometimes even triple drummers, dueling guitar solos, long jam sessions, etc. A few years back, I read a book called Midnight Riders about the Allman Brothers. What was Greg's opinion about that book, and how much of that book affected the writing of his memoir?
Well, we didn't talk a lot specifically about that book. That's really been sort of the main Allman Brothers biography that's out there. And I think Greg's feeling in general about things that have been written about the band is that I don't know that there's a lot that he says is hugely wrong, but I think he feels like they're limited, maybe just limited in the way that reporting from outside is always going to be. I mean, he always made a point of saying that when people talk about the band, they really do concentrate on, the tragedy and the dark side of the band, but that there was so much that was, fun and celebratory and, so much they did that was positive and just isn't talked about as much, isn't concentrated about as much because it's not as dramatic as the other side of the story. So I think that, his concern was wanting to just give a more full sense of all the different things that the band was about and that the years of, the many years and many different configurations of the band were about and what those relationships were about. Certainly I reread the book before we started in on this and obviously tried to get myself as refamiliarized with the details of the story as possible. But I don't think there's anything that was intended as a response or as a reaction to any other single piece of writing out there.
One of the things I wanted to come back to that Tom, our emailer, wrote was about the unique setup that the Allman Brothers had in terms of instrumentation and how they applied it. I don't know of any other big-time rock and roll group that used two drummers, and I'm not talking about two percussion guys, so one guy's on this set of exotic drums and another guy's on a trap set. These are two trap sets, and they're both playing, and also using two lead guitars. Where did those ideas come from?
Well, I guess I would say the one other obvious band with the two drummers was the Grateful Dead, toward a very different effect and a very different style than what the Allman Brothers were about. But that's kind of there's a little bit of a West Coast version and a Southern version of this configuration between those two bands. Where it came from was really Duane's brain and what he was able to hear as he brought these musicians together. Greg talks, I don't know if he spoke to you about it, but he talks about it a lot, about getting that phone call. He was in L.A. Duane had gone back down south after their early band had kind of broken up in L.A. And he gets a call from Duane saying, come out here. I got the band. We're ready. We need you to come out and round this thing up and bring us some songs and come out and sing. And he described the band. He's like, okay, I got two drummers and I got a lead guitar player other than me. And the word that Greg always uses is, he said it just sounded like a train wreck. He says, he couldn't at all imagine what that was going to sound like and how that was going to work. He's like, what do you need another guitar player for? You're the best guitar player I know. And how do you have two drummers? How's that going to work? And then he got there and he got in the room with these guys and says that, once they worked through a bunch of his songs, nothing was quite right. And then then they started to play Dreams. He showed them that song and everything just came together and they played it for hours and hours, and that was it. He could see what the chemistry was and what the potential was. But the mix of musics, this very blues-based and Southern rhythm and blues-based music that had all of this jazz-style improvisation to it, that had a country music feel to it. I mean, there are so many different ingredients and elements that come together in those Allman Brothers records. And a lot of it, you know, in some ways my favorite part of the book is him talking about the early days of the band, first playing together and then moving to Macon, you know, getting their deal and moving to Macon, Georgia, a bunch of them living in a house together, which is now open as a museum in Macon for the Allman Brothers, and the ways that they just lived, breathed, you know, ate and slept music. He talks a lot about what they were listening to, from, you know, from country records to Dylan records to Miles Davis and John Coltrane records, and absorbing all of this stuff and figuring out how to put all of that into what they were doing, that it took a, you know, a 24-hour-a-day commitment and devotion to it to end up with this kind of blend that nobody had heard before.
We have callers waiting, and there's a line available for you if you want to join our discussion right now. Maybe talk about your impressions, your thoughts about the Allman Brothers, about Greg Allman. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can take the email route and send something to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Or you can find the Kathleen Dunn show page on Facebook. Let's hear from Martha in Menominee. Martha, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I think it was 1976 I first saw them. I was 16 or 17 years old. It was at RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. And my older brother was a disc jockey on college radio, and he would come home with all these records. And I was exposed to the Allman Brothers pretty early on then. And I just can't tell you what this brings back, hearing all those old songs. You could pick any Allman Brothers song, and I couldn't have heard it for 30 years, and I could sing every verse and chorus and expect the riff and know the arrangements. It's so fun to hear this show. But the thing for them was it opened up for me all the sources. The old Elmore James records and Willie McTell, and that spurned me to find more old blues players. And then I started listening to slide players. And from Duane Allman, I went to Ry Cooder and Bonnie Raitt and Lowell George. And it was just exponential. I can't, they changed my music life. They really did.
Martha, thanks for the call. Alan Light, would you like to comment on anything Martha
said?
Well,
I think that's, I think that it sounds like she went particularly deep into the different strands of this music, which is fantastic. But I think that, you know, that probably was a common thing for a lot of Allman Brothers listeners. They were always very explicit about, introducing songs that were old blues songs, you know, by their writers on the Fillmore East record. As you said, they'll introduce, there's an Elmore James song, there's a Bobby Blue Bland song. And that's still the music that's certainly closest to Greg's heart. I mean, the solo record that he released last year was almost all old classic blues songs. And any time that I've been around him, he's listening to Muddy Waters records or B.B. King records, and that's still very deep in their veins. But also, it's a nice point that Martha makes about the way that it opened up, you know, into their contemporaries and into the future, and the way that Duane's slide playing did, you know, resonate through Bonnie Raitt, through Little Feat, through these other rock and roll players that followed. They really were a linchpin in that way, a turning point. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot going in and there's a lot coming out, and I think that's something that certainly something Greg is very aware of and very proud of.
We're talking about the memoir, My Cross to Bear, Greg Allman, with Alan Light. Wondering what you think about what was, did you listen to the Allman Brothers maybe when you were in college like a lot of us did, or maybe you found them in high school, or maybe you discovered them much later, had never heard of them before, and maybe discovered them by accident and wondered, what in the world is this? It really was a different, in a way, even though this was a style that had been around. The blues obviously has been around for a long time, but the way they approached it was a lot different. And I wanted to get your impressions, because one of the things, when you listen to the music, yes, they have these extended jams, and yet even though they're improvising, the improvisations are, in a way, very precise and very coordinated. It's like everybody is really on the same page here, and it's almost seems like one hand is playing all the instruments at once.
Well, I think that's, certainly I think that's true, and I think at their best that there is that combination of exploration and looseness combined with discipline and just straight musicianship that lets them follow these different avenues and yet stay very much in sync and rise and fall together. That's when you're aware of just how good these players are and also of just how much they played together, how much they're aware of what each one of them is capable of or where they may go at any moment. In those ways, it is a lot more like a jazz band. Obviously loud and electrified and all of those things, but there's a lot of that kind of approach to improvisation. And I just go back to Greg talking about those years of them basically living together, getting up in the morning, playing for hours, going to eat together, coming back, playing for hours, playing, for free in the parks and at any opportunity to get in front of people, and that was all they wanted to do. In some ways, Greg talks a lot about the way that their success, as many people go through, that the success was really what started to separate them, what started to cause rifts in personality and direction, enabled them to pursue the vices or interests that they had. And that I think the years he looks back on fondest are, those years before they made it, when it was really all about their friendship and their music.
One of the things that came up in our chat the other day, it was Greg was talking about, I asked him about songwriting, and he talked about writing Melissa and said that was really one of the first songs that he wrote that he actually liked. He said a lot of the stuff he had written early on, he said it was all just crap. Let's listen to that cut now.
I got tired of playing other people's stuff real fast. I started writing probably about 15, 16, and I mean, it was just garbage. I mean, they say some people are born with it. Well, it wasn't me. And I slaved over them, man. And I'd get through with one, and I would take it to show it to my brother, and he'd say, well, you've written different lyrics to such and such a song, right? I'd go, damn. So I kept on trying, and then when I was 17, I wrote Melissa. And I didn't even show it to anybody for probably, it was well over a year. So it's closer to 2 years.
Did you have any idea when you were writing it this was going to end up being one of your big songs you were known for?
Absolutely not, because all the ones before that were just garbage. And that's where they went, right in the garbage.
Melissa. Whipping Post. Nobody can hear that intro and not know what they're listening to, because that was a unique piece of music writing there, and actually quite complex to terms of the time signature and so forth. We're talking about Greg Allman's memoir, My Cross to Bear, written with Alan Light. Alan Light is with us. He's a former editor-in-chief of Spin Magazine and frequent contributor to Rolling Stone and the New York Times. He joins me by phone. You can, too, at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, or find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page and leave your comment or question there. One of the things that the book chronicles is the various ups and downs of the Allman Brothers Band, and certainly the death of Duane Allman in 1971, which was, you know, ironically, just as their careers were really taken off, they had a really good fan following, and they had this huge live album. They were working on Eat a Peach, and Duane dies, and it really seemed like that took a lot out of the band. Obviously, it really affected Greg. It seems to me that I just got the impression that that event and then and the tragedy that almost immediately followed it that was a real turning point for the band. Talk about that time in their career.
Well, I think it's absolutely, you know, the central moment of Greg's story and of the story of the band. I don't know, it's something beyond ironic, I suppose. You know, they put out their first two records to really very little response. The Allman Brothers Band record and the Idle Wild South record really didn't sell much, didn't do much of anything. And, you know, then it was decided they should take a shot at a live record that really, you know, they were doing something so special playing live that they should put that out. So they recorded the Fillmore East record. And, you know, quite literally, just as that record started to explode, just as they were starting to attain what it is they'd been, you know, they'd been dreaming of and striving for, you know, Duane dies in the motorcycle accident. And I think that, you know, for Greg, that's there are several levels. That's his brother, his idol, the male figure that he looked up to throughout his whole life. But also, Duane was the leader of that band. Duane was the one who brought all the musicians together, who had the vision for where things could go. You know, when you listen to the Fillmore East record, it's Duane who introduces the songs. It's not, you know, Greg's the lead singer, but he's not the spokesman. So it was, you know, it was a blow on so many levels that, you know, Greg says he thinks about every day to this day. And really shifted the dynamics. You know, there was no replacing a musician of the caliber and the unique style of what Duane could do. So they needed to figure out creatively what the right direction to go was, and they needed to figure out what their relationships were, who was going to be directing things. That really set in motion a lot of the tension with Dickie Betts that ultimately led to to his departure from the group after several breakups, but his, you know, finally his departure in around 10 years ago. Everything really kind of spirals into a different place when Duane dies in 1971.
Well, let's talk about, first of all, about the original lineup. Make sure we get all the characters in the right places here. The original lineup of the Allman Brothers Band. Well, for the Fillmore East album, for example, talk a little bit about who they were, because they were all really, really special musicians.
Well, you have Greg, you know, singing and primarily playing the organ, the Hammond organ, though he sometimes still plays guitar, especially in his solo work, really holds the organ spot in the band. At that point, the guitar players were Duane and Dickie Betts. Two very different styles, the really kind of fluid, you know, slide playing of Duane and a much more kind of aggressive and spiky playing that Dickie had, also a more country-flavored kind of style from Dickie. Dickie, of course, wrote Ramblin' Man and a couple of the later hits for the band that have a kind of a little bit of a different feel to them. Barry Oakley was the bass player, who sort of came out of a Chicago blues background, a different background than the other guys did, and had a very melodic bass playing style, was really able to follow a lot of the different turns that the band was taking while also maintaining a rhythmic bass to it. Barry died a year almost to the day in almost the same location that Duane died. And Greg says in the book that really after Duane died, Barry never recovered, and it was a terrible year with him. Really descending into a bad drinking problem and bad depression, and that in a lot of ways they were relieved when Barry had his accident because he was in so much pain before that. And then you had the drummers. You have J-Mo and Butch Trux, who to this day are the drummers in the Allman Brothers Band, the two who have stuck it out alongside Greg through all these years. I guess it's funny that the Spinal Tap version is that the drummers are the first ones to go, but in this band, the drummers are the ones who've hung on. And Greg talks a lot about his relationship to J-Mo in the book, who is African American, and that in the 60s in the South, that the fact that they had an integrated band, had a black musician playing with them, was obviously a controversial thing and a thing they had to put up their fists and defend a lot of the time. And, Greg says that over time, he's really, that's the person that he's closest to, that after his brother, the person in the band that he's really felt the most, the closest and the longest relationship to was J-Mo. And so it's a diverse collection of personalities and music styles that are all represented up there. J-Mo had come from a straight R&B background. He had been part of Otis Redding and the Stax. That band, the touring band at one point. So there's a lot of different things that were going on that stage.
We have some callers who want to join us. Let's go to Minocqua and hear from Jeff first. Jeff, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. I really, really can't thank enough for this program. I just only wish that Greg was listening, because I'd surely like to thank him for all the wonderful music he's provided us along with the band. Huge fan of these guys. And, I saw Greg down at in Wausau a few years back at the Grand Theater down there. It was just an awesome show. He's just he's a guy I'd love to meet one day, and he influences me with my music more than anybody. And I'm glad to see he made it through his health issues and so forth, and loved what he's putting out lately. And just thanks a ton for all the great music he's provided us, and we'll be looking forward to hearing more as we go.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Alan Light?
Well, I think we should, not let the full show go without, as Jeff just did, at least bringing up Greg's health issues over the last few years, because I think that, that was certainly part of the motivation to sit down and get this story really told. It's been a really rough last few years for Greg after many efforts and varying degrees of success, finally getting sober. In the 90s, somewhere a number of years later, discovered that he had contracted hepatitis C. He's been a very active spokesman for Hep C in the years since. And he had a liver transplant. We're coming up on 2 years ago, this summer. And, as anybody can tell you, that, nothing's easy when you go through an organ transplant like that. And little medical issues can spiral into major ones very quickly. He's had to fight off a lot of different ailments over the last few years. When we were first just getting started on this book, he had an issue with his lungs, which he discusses at length in the book, that was really we nearly lost him last summer for good over a related but not the same issue. He recently had to miss the last night of the Allman Brothers stand at the Beacon Theater, that they play every year in New York, because one of the discs in his back popped out. It's been very touch and go with his health. He's in a good place right now. I was with him in L.A. a couple weeks ago and in New York last week, and he's doing a good job of fighting through this promotion. But, it's... we hope for the best with his health day in, day out. And it was really gratifying that he was able to stay strong through the period we were working on this book so that we could get everything done.
Tim in Green Bay, you'll be next. Good morning, Tim.
I keep hearing about the Fillmore East concert on DVD. Do you know if that's going to come out for real, or is that positive thinking?
I don't know the full answer to that. I think it's probably positive thinking, because I don't think there's that much of it. You've maybe seen just recently, within the last, 6 months or so, there's a couple of clips that have gone up online. I think it's through the Wolfgang's Vault site that's the site that has all the Bill Graham archives from the Fillmore theaters. There's a clip of them playing Dreams and a clip maybe of Elizabeth Reed or something, but there's two or three songs that were shot. And it's fantastic to see them because there's so little, there's so little opportunity to watch Dwayne play on a stage. There were some really, given the technological limitations, there were different efforts that were made to shoot the band back then. There was a Don Kirshner's rock concert maybe, or a midnight special. There was one thing that was supposed to be their first show, I think, that was also from the Fillmore where the sound got messed up. So I think that this stuff that's come out recently has been really exciting, but I don't know how much more of that actually exists on film. So I don't know what I've certainly not heard of plans to do a full-length anything out of that, but maybe there's more. I mean, Greg says they have everything recorded. He says he tends not to go through it. He wants to kind of save it up until they're not playing and then be able to go back and listen and hear his brother play again. But there's a whole lot of stuff that's sitting there, and they've been doing archival releases, every year or so, hitting the note, which is the Allman Brothers, fanzine. They've been overseeing some of that the archival releases. So I don't know what's still out there to come out.
Thanks for the call, Tim. We'll go to Don in Madison next. Don, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was thinking about, I was living out in Haight-Ashbury in 66, 67, and there was this band that everybody that I was hanging with was telling me about playing at the street theater on Haight Street every Saturday for free, called the Allman Brothers, and I was like, I never heard of them, and oh, they're from Georgia. I was like, yeah, right, probably some southern band, and I never went to see them for the whole time. I think they were playing there all summer. They'd come and were living in the Haight and were playing for free every Saturday at the street theater, and finally, after I got back to Madison, back to college, 3 years later, I heard them and was totally... Well, it's my favorite band, bar none, and I just could kick myself hundreds of times over for ever going to see them when they were playing for free.
Well, it's hard to know which are going to, which are the real ones and which are going to be the great ones, especially early on. And I'm sure it sounded crazy at the time, these, band from down south with a couple of guitar players. I mean, that could have been any kind of thing, but... it's a funny relationship with San Francisco and with that scene that Greg has. I mean, I think he feels like they were never fully embraced by that community. But the person he talks about with so much love is Bill Graham, and all the support at the Fillmore East and Fillmore West. He said there were years where the band would just go back and forth, playing one, playing the other, driving coast to coast to be able to play those theaters because they loved them so much.
Tracy writes on Facebook, one of the best concerts I ever went to was one of Barry Fay's Super Sundays at Mile High Stadium in Denver, Colorado in 1977. Greg Allman, Poco, Outlaws, Charlie Daniels, Per Prairie League, and the finisher was Leonard Skinner when Freebird was going on. She sure does miss those concert days. A lot of people do. You mentioned that the Allman Brothers Band is still playing annually at the Beacon. And those concerts have been pretty well received?
Well, they've done, they passed 200 shows last year. They've been playing for 21 years, 10 or 12 or 15 shows in the month of March. I mean, that has really become a residency, a relationship that, I'm not sure any band has had with a single theater in quite the same way. And, there's something really special that happens at that show. I've gone... over most of the recent years, and it's that's not like going to a regular show. It's knowing that they're there for a couple of weeks and trying different things and bringing in many different guests, and it's all kind of one ongoing, you know, one ongoing event. So they're really, those are really amazing things to see. But the band's going back out this summer. They're doing their own. They're doing Allman Brothers dates. They're doing a series of co-headlining dates with Santana, 8 or 9 shows, which should be really, really fun. So
wow,
they're still out there working.
Amazing, and their fans have stuck with them. We're in the last minute here. Was there anything we didn't get to this hour that you really think we have to before we close it out?
There are so many things. We've got a whole book to go through, but
people can read it for themselves.
I mean, I will say, so many people, and not surprisingly, have concentrated on a lot of the gossip and the six wives and the time with Cher, and you know, all of that stuff is stuff that Greg talks about in the book. But you know, it's nice to see you and your listeners concentrate on the music, which is really the stuff that's most important to him, and I think what we really wanted to concentrate on in the book. The response has been great. Fans have really been loving it, and that's very, very gratifying, because you know, okay, they'd be the first ones to complain. So guess we got it right.
Alan Light, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Glad to do it.
This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, and Rhonda handled on-air production this hour. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Have a great weekend, everybody. Let's listen to the Allman Brothers.